You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 28th of January 2014 on Monocle 24.
Hello from Studio One in London and welcome to Midori House. I'm Andrew Tuck. Coming up on today's show, from Kiev to Kabul, to Morsi's trial in Egypt and Obama's State of the Union address later tonight, we'll review the top stories with James Boyes and Shashank Yoshi. Then we'll sit down with one of Argentina's most prominent graphic designers who, perhaps a tad counterintuitively, does a great deal of his visual work on the radio.
I try to explain, not to describe, the idea through the design. It's a beautiful way to explain or to introduce to the mass media the graphic idea.
Plus, we'll speak to our man in San Francisco, Alistair G, and... Luke Turner of The Quietus will join me in the studio for our weekly music review. All that and more on Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck. So lots coming up in the next hour here on Midori House. But before all that, here's Paul Osborne with the latest news.
Ukraine's prime minister has resigned along with the rest of the cabinet in the latest attempt to end increasingly violent protests in Kiev and other cities. Mykola Azarov's resignation came hours after Ukraine's parliament voted to scrap controversial laws restricting the right to protest. At least five people have been killed in violence linked to the protests. Stefan Meister from the European Council on Foreign Relations warns opponents of the president, Viktor Yanukovych, will want more.
This is just a minimal demand of the opposition, of the demonstrators, that one of the most hated person in the government will leave his office. And I think this can be only a first step. For many, this is only a lip service. Yeah, and now they need really more steps, other steps.
The former Bosnian Serb army chief Ratko Mladic has refused to testify as a defense witness for the former Bosnian Serb leader Radovan Karadzic. Both men deny charges of war crimes and crimes against humanity at a UN tribunal in The Hague. Mr. Mladic dismissed the hearing as satanic and said testifying at Mr. Karadzic's trial could prejudice his own case. Talks on the civil war in Syria have been suspended, with little sign the rival sides are moving any closer to an agreement. They've been unable to make progress on issues including getting humanitarian aid to the besieged city of Homs. And opposition activists say representatives of the Syrian regime will not consider demands for Bashar al-Assad to stand down. Syria's Deputy Foreign Minister Faisal Mekdad accuses the opposition of deliberately trying to sabotage the talks.
Suddenly, the other party said they don't agree with such a statement and that they support the United States' steps to arm terrorist groups and to provide them with all kinds of weapons.
South Sudan's government is accusing rebels of violating a recently agreed ceasefire. The deal came into effect last Friday to try to end violence in which hundreds have died and up to 500,000 have been displaced. But South Sudan's information minister Michael Makuei claims that opposition forces have ignored the ceasefire and launched fresh attacks.
The rebels continue to violate the cessation of hostilities from then up to now. And this is simply because the agreement is defective. They continue to violate and attack our forces wherever they are.
Egypt's former president, Mohamed Morsi, has made a defiant appearance in court at the start of his latest trial. Alongside other members of his Muslim Brotherhood, he's accused of organizing the escape of thousands of prisoners in the early days of the uprising in Egypt 3 years ago. 6 months after being deposed by the military, Mr. Morsi told the court that he remains the legitimate leader of the country. It's his first public appearance since the last time he was in court in early November. Thailand's government says elections will go ahead on Sunday as planned, despite threatened protests and an opposition boycott. The Prime Minister Yingluck Shinawatra met election officials in Bangkok earlier. They demanded the vote be delayed, saying it's impossible to stage a fair poll in the current climate. Anti-government protesters are demanding wider reforms and say Ms. Shinawatra must step down. A new anti-corruption party in India says it will field more than 70 candidates in national elections this year. The Young Anti-Graft Party took power in Delhi last month and now says it will target politicians accused of crimes. Arvind Kejriwal founded the party.
The most important thing is there are a large number of cabinet ministers who have indulged in corruption. They need to be defeated. We'll put up strong candidates against them. Now it is for the people to decide whether they want to support clean politics or not. Earlier the people used to say we didn't have option. Now we'll provide them a clean option.
That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Paul. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. We're going to be right back after this.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Tu vai Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Dette Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost, see on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo, Monocle 24 des.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House and the time here in London is 18.06, which means it's 13.06 in New York. And joining me now with their take on the news is James Boyes, Senior Visiting Fellow at King's College London, and Shashank Yoshi, Research Fellow at the Royal United Services Institute. Welcome both to the programme, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
There's only one place we can restart, obviously, today, and that's Ukraine. Today has been eventful in Kiev, to say the least. President Viktor Yanukovych has accepted his prime minister's resignation, and the parliament has struck down the anti-protest law that sparked much of the unrest in the country. James, let's come to you first. What next do you think for Yanukovych? It's an interesting situation as we've watched what's played out over today. It's great having a protest movement, but you have to know, you know, how far you're going to push it and what you're going to ask for. So they've got certainly, you know, Some of the things they've been asking for, you know, the prime minister stepped down. This protest law is going to be struck down, but ultimately they did want Yanukovych to resign. Do you think that's likely, or do you think now it's time for, if you're an opposition movement, to start being a little bit more strategic and maybe kind of making some deals?
Yeah, it's going to be very interesting to see what happens. If you look at the sort of the history of movements across the recent era, you see, trying to draw any sort of parallels from the Arab Spring movement, for example, I think it's very, very difficult to try and draw any great parallels of history. One of the challenges I think you have with Ukraine is the fact that the country appears to be basically split right down the middle, almost geographically, between those who would rather ally with Europe and those who are much more inclined to follow the Kremlin path. If you look at what they've achieved so far, I think that realistically you should say, well, they should, perhaps should be satisfied and, you know, basically go home and pack up the tents. Will that happen? I think one of the problems is that there's a degree to which once you start down this sort of, for want of a better word, revolutionary movement, it almost becomes self-perpetuating with this idea that, well, now we've got such and such, now we should perhaps push on and get more. I think there's a degree to which perhaps the officials at the heart of this may well feel inclined to do that. Whether they'll be able to control the people on the streets and get them to go back home and live with the deal would be another matter, I think.
And Shashank, for you, obviously Yanukovych, we've had this feeling that he was kind of listening more to the Kremlin. Do you think they would have wanted him to make some kind of peace? You know, why do you think he's suddenly relented and kind of given the protesters some of what they wanted?
Well, I think first of all, he's realised the scale of what he's up against, and he tried repression. And it didn't work. It simply catalyzed further protest. Parliament in Ukraine passed an incredibly repressive law, basically banning freedom of association and freedom of speech. And in the, you know, he assumed that that would take the sting out of the protests and allow security forces to round them up. It didn't work. And he realized, I think, with protesters coming up against ministries, nearly seizing the justice ministry over the weekend, that if he didn't try and split the protest movement somehow, it would only get stronger. I think what he's done is a fairly clever move. He's made some fairly far-reaching concessions. None of them actually pertain to the original issue, the issue of where Ukraine is going to ally with the EU or with Russia. But he has said he'll get rid of the repressive laws that were passed. He will offer key posts to opposition leaders. And I think it's a clever game. He knows it won't be enough for the masses in the streets, but it may be enough for the protest elite leaders. And splitting those movements is the best way to take the sting out of them.
James, as we watch, Putin's been in Brussels today meeting the EU. And apparently one sign that he wasn't so welcome is that they haven't cooked him dinner tonight. I'm not sure if how upset he'll be not getting a kind of a Brussels roast this evening. But
no muscles in Brussels.
If we look at the Putin-ometer, as it were, over the last few days, he seemed to have played, again, a very clever winning hand in Ukraine. Do you think his influence is dented? Do you think he'll be slightly stung by the way events are turning out?
If I've learnt one thing over the last couple of years, it's never count out Vladimir Putin. This is someone who is such a master of the game. Effectively, he came to power rather successfully, obviously with the demise of Boris Yeltsin. Held power either directly or indirectly ever since. He really has played a blinder with regards to Syria. There's no doubt about it that he has really taken the hit on the international sphere with regard to the Winter Olympics and his whole positioning with regard to the gay community. But I think in terms of hard power, he's someone who can play the game and has repeatedly outclassed his Western opponents.
I'm not so sure about that. He certainly played his cards reasonably well, but I think he's got a fantastic strategy until it all falls apart. Certainly in Syria, we were told he had played a masterstroke, but I'm not sure that having his ally completely disarmed and shorn of chemical weapons was in fact such a victory for Putin. I don't know if Putin is fully in control of events. Is he in control of the concessions being offered to protest leaders? Is he so sure that Yanukovych won't at a later point turn around and look westward again? I think that it's very, very easy to credit Putin with a lot until that moment where a regime in Kiev collapses, and I wouldn't rule that out.
I would say, just add to that, which is I don't think Vladimir Putin would claim to be in control of events, but I think what he's done is very masterfully manipulate events. And with regard to Syria, sure, the chemical weapons are taken out of there, but how many more tens of thousands of people have been killed with normal armaments as opposed to chemical weapons?
Sure. I think there's one more point to make here, which is it's not just a question of his strengths and capabilities, it's also EU weaknesses.
Absolutely.
One of the issues here is the Ukraine desperately needs cash, and Putin has that cash, and the EU can't stump it up. This isn't just about ideology. Yanukovych isn't some hardened, pro-Soviet apparatchik. He would probably in his heart prefer to look west, but they haven't got the money.
Shashank, do you think there's any risk of a kind of a South Ossetia moment where, he says, okay, the Russian speakers in the east of the country, they need our protection. Yanukovych needs our protection. We're going to send in some troops to shore up the border. Do you think just potentially Sochi will save us, but do you think there's any risk of that?
Sort of Prague Spring moment. No, I really don't think there is at all. Times have changed. I don't think militarily Russia could get away with that. And in addition to that, I think although there is a geographic split, I think it also is worth remembering it's not immediately a purely contiguous area of control such that all of the East favours Putin, all of the West favours the EU. Actually, you have lots and lots of Russian speakers in the West, lots of Ukrainian speakers in the East, and here's the really important thing people forget when looking at this, most Ukrainians are bilingual. So the statistics we read about X number speaking Russian, X Y percent speaking Ukrainian, these are quite misleading. Most people are bilingual and it's not such a clear-cut split, and so there's no natural constituency for Putin to defend.
Well, let's now look at another man whose fate was sealed by masses of protesters this year. The former Egyptian president, Mohamed Morsi, has appeared in front of a Cairo court today. He was kept away from the public in a soundproof glass box, but everyone heard him shout against those who ousted him last year. There have been some quite dramatic scenes today, and the odd moments we could hear him speak. He said he'd been kept in filth, that he was still the legitimate president. He's now on trial for an attempted prison break a couple of years ago. There are four court cases now lined up against him. James, perhaps we will start with you on this one. What does it say to the outside world, do you think? Is it just literally the Egyptian version of Groundhog Day? We're back to, you know, we're back to Mubarak.
Yeah, who'd be a leader in the Muslim world, quite frankly? It does make you wonder where this is all going to end, I think. You know, I'm sure that when Morsi came to power, he thought, here we go, fantastic. You know, we've had 30 years of one leadership, we can set up another. Now, all of a sudden, he's obviously, the tide has turned. He is now in the Mubarak situation. One wonders who is next and where this is all heading. There seems to be a complete lack of any direction or sense of where this is going to end up. And I think anybody who would care to profess where this would go would get themselves into quite hot water very quickly. What does seem clear, I think, is that we're going to see chaos. I think we're going to see chaotic scenes. There's no doubt that Morsi has a point. The guy was, you know, duly elected leader of this country. He's been overthrown in a coup. The direction of Western policy with regards to this is problematic, I think. So whatever one thinks of ex-President Morsi, he does perhaps have a point.
Shashank, when we look, we won't return to Ukraine, but when we look at what's happening to Timoshenko there and how the Europe has kind of complained and complained about her treatment, and you know, compared to Morsi, it's hardly anything, but absolute silence from Western governments. Nobody is putting up a hand really and saying what's being done to him is wrong. You know, you need to do something about the situation. Do you think that's it's an embarrassment?
I think it is. I think it also represents, of course, the comparatively few levers we have over the situation. You know, Europe, Catherine Ashton, the High Representative for the EU, has made some fairly tepid statements about this. But what they've usually said is, we support the democratic transition plans set out by the Egyptian interim government. Now, I have to tell you, that democratic transition plan involves a man in a general's uniform, a field marshal's uniform as of last week, in big sunglasses, getting on national television and saying how great he is, and being duly appointed with 98% of the vote. Scenes I can point to you from any moment in Egyptian history going back to 1953. So I think it really represents a fundamental weakness on the part of Europe. The American situation is a little bit different, I think. They have levers, and they did indeed suspend a small amount of aid last year in response to the coup. However, this is a very, very sensitive moment in US Middle Eastern diplomacy. Israel-Palestinian peace talks are ongoing, and the Egyptian army specifically plays a key role in events into the north in places like the Gaza Strip, which in turn affects the state of those Israel-Palestine talks. Those are a priority, and I don't think Washington is ready at this point to do anything to rock the boat on those. Having said that, I think a lot of people in the White House will be saying to Obama, we'd like to do something, but this is a matter of existential importance to the Egyptian army. You can do whatever you like, they will be seizing power.
James, you know, again, when we look at this situation, do you think for foreign ministers sitting in, whether in Washington or in Europe, it must just make them think, you know, we had so many dreams and aspirations, what would happen here? You know, we must be very cautious how we deal with these situations in the future. We can't be seen to be so kind of gung-ho in the beginning.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, Shashank rightly points out, as I was discussing, this idea of what the United States' role in all this is. And for many decades, democratic promotion has been at the heart of U.S. foreign policy. I think that's somewhat discredited in the aftermath of the George W. Bush administration. I think it's one of the reasons that Obama is very hesitant to use that expression and come out with these concepts. It seemed to have been very, very difficult, if not impossible, to implement. If you look at what's gone on with Egypt, one of the problems you've got is that the aid package to Egypt, which totals some $1.3 billion a year, is very much tied up with the deal that the Israelis get. It was part of a deal agreed after Camp David, for example. You cannot separate the whole issue with regard to Egypt with Israel, and that brings you into whole issues to do with lobbying, etc., etc. So it's a real challenge
and
as
Israel,
to how to move
Israel's
with this.
Fundamental security.
Absolutely.
I mean, completely there was an Egyptian military helicopter downed in the Sinai Peninsula 2 days ago by a surface-to-air missile from Egyptian militants. Now, I personally think the strategy of the Egyptian authorities are taking is going to worsen that problem, not mitigate it and make it worse for Israel. But this is how the Obama White House will be looking at this.
Well, gentlemen, we have more stories we want to fit in this half hour. So we're going to take a short break now, but you're listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Tuck, and James Boyes and Shashank Yoshi will be here when we return. We're going to discuss Obama's State of the Union-to-be, and we'll ask whether Afghanistan is right to release from jail men that America deems very dangerous. That's up next.
All around the world, Monocle 24's growing network of correspondents bring you the latest news, reportage, and insight. from New York to Nairobi, Bamako to Berlin.
From Monocle in Paris, I'm Tom Burgess-Watson.
From Monocle in Berlin, I'm Kimberly Bradley.
From Monocle in Pristina.
In New York.
In Cairo.
In Sao Paulo.
I'm Guy Delorme.
From Monocle.
From Monocle.
In Tel Aviv.
From Monocle.
In San Francisco.
In North Vancouver.
In Ramallah.
I'm Aisha Spears.
I'm Joseph Dane.
From Monocle, I'm Sheena Rossiter.
In Bogota.
In London.
Bangkok.
Buenos Aires.
So, whether you want to know what's happening in the corridors of power, in the boardrooms of the aviation giants, or the must-sees at the latest film festival, stay tuned to Monocle 24. Monocle 24, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
And welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Still with me is James Boyes, Senior Visiting Fellow at King's College London, and Shashank Joshi from the Royal United Services Institute. We turn now to Western presidential problems. Tonight, Barack Obama will pronounce his State of the Union address, and he finds himself in a rather uncomfortable position. As the New York Times has summed it up, the economy has rarely been better, and yet the president's approval ratings have rarely been worse. But before we start asking how Obama can get Americans to trust him once again, we thought we'd play you some of the most memorable addresses to date, from George Bush's Axis of Evil State of the Union to Bill Clinton's 1996 address, or even Richard Nixon's 1974 Watergate speech.
I would like to add a personal word with regard to an issue that has been of great concern to all Americans over the past year. I refer, of course, to the investigations of the so-called Watergate affair. As you know, I have provided to the special prosecutor voluntarily a great deal of material. I believe that I have provided all the material that he needs to conclude his investigations and to proceed to prosecute the guilty and to clear the innocent.
The era of big government is over. But we cannot go back to the time when our citizens were left to fend for themselves. Instead, we must go forward as one America, one nation, working together to meet the challenges we face together. Self-reliance and teamwork are not opposing virtues. We must have both.
States like these and their terrorist allies constitute an axis of evil, arming to threaten the peace of the world. By seeking weapons of mass destruction, these regimes pose a grave and growing danger.
Well, those were a mashup of some of the more memorable State of the Union addresses, set, I think, to Star Wars music, come Gone with the Wind. So just to make some added drama there. And of course, those were the recorded ones, because I imagine that some of the earlier ones, which weren't recorded, were rather memorable as well. Now, it was interesting, James, to hear there Clinton speaking.
Yeah.
When he spoke, 66 million people tuned in to listen to him speak. They're thinking maybe 30 million could potentially listen to Obama. Do we care anymore?
Let me tell you something else about Bill Clinton. When he first addressed the State of the Union in 1994, he got to the well of Congress and realized that the wrong speech had been loaded into the teleprompter. It's a true story. He ad-libbed the State of the Union for 20 minutes, and then they dropped the right speech in, and no one could tell from his delivery at what point the wrong speech dropped in. The guy was a genius, and also the focus of my book, which I'm working on at the moment, Clinton's Grand Strategy. What's fascinating about the State of the Union is it's only become political theater, really, since 1960s. The Constitution says the president has to deliver the State of the Union. It used to be delivered as a document, effectively. Lyndon Johnson comes in and makes it a big primetime speech. It has been ever since. 60, 70 million Americans have watched. If fewer people watch and the figures you quote are correct, it's still going to be the highlight of the president's year in terms of his ability to reach out and directly speak to the American people. It's his opportunity tonight to relaunch his presidency, and he better well do so from Barack Obama's point of view.
Shashank, it's his chance to kind of lay out a kind of legislative program for the year ahead. Yeah. He did that last year. He talked about guns. He talked about immigration. Yeah. He talked about lots of things that never happened.
Yeah.
I guess that's why there's a diminishing interest in his speech. This time around, they're saying maybe immigration will be back on the agenda, maybe the minimum wage. But again, he's right at the end of his presidency. Is there really much that he can tell the American public that he can genuinely achieve?
Yeah, lame duck State of the Union's role is different. And Obama has a uniquely defensive, particularly defensive aspect to this one. You said legislative program. That's interesting because many of the sounds coming out of this White House are that precisely because of the legislative gridlock, he'll be looking to see what he can do through executive action alone, executive orders and the authority of the presidency, which is in a way an admission of defeat, saying I can't really pass big laws. I'll just have to use my residual powers to do what I can. But I think the tone really is one now of defending a legacy that looks far diminished to that which one might have expected 4 years ago. There's a fantastic interview he gave to the New Yorker's David Remnick, a big interview, where the tone is such that he's saying, he says, you know, we all only get a little chunk of history. Our only job is to get our paragraph right. He's not interested in changing history anymore. He's interested in editing his little paragraph around the margins to make sure he doesn't look like a failure at the end of all of this.
And the timescales that Shashank just mentioned are very important. Four years ago, the Democrats lose control of the House of Representatives. And from that point onwards, Obama has struggled singularly to get anything done. The masterpiece of his legislation, the Health Care Act, was passed in the first 2 years of his administration when he had a democratically controlled Congress. His inability to master the personal art of politics, both domestically and internationally, I think will absolutely handicap any legislation he wants to get through and will be a massive blot upon his legacy moving forward.
We want to jump to Afghanistan in 1 minute, but Shashank, just finally on that, is his failure at that politics, his inability to build any kind of consensus with opposition, with his own party even, he seems an absolute failure at carrying people along with him.
Yes, I mean, he has faced particularly polarized circumstances, but certainly what you consistently see from people who've worked in his administration is that he's this sense of aloofness, this loyaliness carries through into his legislative style. I mean, you know better than me, but it seems to be the opposite of the Clintonian style, which was, characteristically warm and the very opposite of aloof, dealing with legislators, lawmakers to persuade them. Now, would he have been able to persuade Congress on every one of his measures? I'm not sure any amount of persuasion would have changed their minds on things like the Iran bills, but on a broad legislative agenda, that has suffered because of his lack of personal attention.
I'm going to have to stop you, gentlemen, there, because we do want to just get the final topic in. Because before we go there, we want to look at a problem that's also probably nagging Barack Obama, the transition out of Afghanistan. Kabul is releasing 37 dangerous individuals said to have been involved in attacks against the US and currently jailed in the prison of Bagram. Hamid Karzai says that jail is a Taliban making factory. Shashank, why is he doing this, and is it a good or bad thing?
It's a bad thing. He's doing it to play to domestic nationalist constituencies, but it's far from the worst thing he's doing. Mm. What's worse is that this is just one small part of a giant strategy to malign the United States and malign those of his allies who've spent 12 years fighting for blood and treasure in his country. And the worst thing this weekend was his suggestion that he's keeping a list where he thinks the US has conducted terrorist attacks on American soldiers, on his own government institutions. So I think Karzai has utterly lost the plot, and he thinks he's doing it to keep his grip on power, to show he can stand up to the Americans. But the culmination of this could well be a very, very hasty departure of US forces, and one that will leave him much worse for the wear.
James, you're reading the situation.
Yeah, I mean, let's be honest about it. Would Karzai be in control now if it wasn't for the American support that he got at the beginning of his reign? Absolutely not. It's a shocking, I think, indictment of his administration and a complete repudiation of everything that we've tried to do in that part of the world. And when you think about the blood and treasure that has been spilt in trying to bring some sort of democracy to that part of the world and keep Karzai in power, I think it's really quite a damning indictment of himself rather than anything he could come out with.
Shashank, just before we wind up, he's mercurial to say the least, Karzai. What is his game? Is his game to try and keep power, do you think, after the Americans are gone? Surely even he must recognise that is going to be a very tricky game to play if he really does, burn all his bridges with the allies.
You say mercurial, I say off his meds, but I think you're absolutely right. He's building a small annex next to the presidential palace. I'm not joking, an actual granny house on the site of the palace. So he wants to be continual presence. I don't think he'll stay in power. I think what he wants to do is be kingmaker, father of the nation, who stands above and can anoint a chosen successor.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there, gentlemen. That was James Boyes and Shashank Joshi. And with the day's top stories, thank you both for joining us here at Midori House.
Vanuit London, dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres, essa é a Monocle 24.
位于伦敦, 这是 Monocle 24.
London, du er Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette er Monocle 24.
From London,
this is Londres.
Hollanda,
London. London으로부터
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
This is Monocle 24.
Plenty still to come then in the second half of today's Midori House. We'll be on the line with our man in San Francisco, Alistair G, and we'll review the week in music. And
I try to explain, not to describe, the idea through the design. It's a beautiful way to explain or to introduce to the mass media the graphic idea.
We'll meet a graphic designer who has turned visual icons into radio. But before we get started on that, here's Paul Osborne with the world news headlines.
The Prime Minister of Ukraine has resigned, along with the rest of his cabinet. It's the latest attempt to end the increasingly violent protests in Kiev. Mykola Azarov's resignation came just hours after the Ukrainian parliament voted to scrap the laws which restricted the right to protest. The former Bosnian Serb army chief, Ratko Mladic, has refused to testify as a defence witness in the trial of the former Bosnian Serb leader, Radovan Karadzic. Both men deny charges of war crimes and crimes against humanity in separate hearings at a UN tribunal in The Hague. But Mr. Mladic said testifying for Mr. Karadzic could prejudice his own case. Talks on the civil war in Syria have been suspended in Geneva, and there is little sign the rival sides are moving any closer to an agreement. They've been unable to make progress on issues including getting humanitarian aid to the besieged city of Homs. An opposition activist say that representatives of the Syrian regime will not consider demands for Bashar al-Assad to stand down. Egypt's former president Mohamed Morsi's made a defiant appearance in court at the start of his latest trial. Alongside other members of the Muslim Brotherhood, he's accused of organising the escape of thousands of prisoners in the early days of the uprising 3 years ago. He told the court that he is still the legitimate leader of the country. And Thailand's government has said elections will go ahead on Sunday as planned, despite threats of protests and a boycott by the opposition. The Prime Minister Yingluck Shinawatra met election officials in Bangkok, who had demanded the vote be delayed, saying it would be impossible to stage a fair poll in the current circumstances. And those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Paul. And welcome back to Midori House, live here on Monocle 24. The time now is 18:32 here in London, which means it's 10:32 in San Francisco, where we head now for a chat with our correspondent there, Alistair G. Alistair, thank you for coming on the show. Now, we're going to start with a very unusual story. A story I think rarely makes the top of the news, topiary, and in particular, Daniel Steele's hedge.
Yeah, so it's been called Hedgegate, and it's quite a bizarre story, so bear with me. So this all began with a hedge. The prolific author Danielle Steele, she has an enormous French chateau-style house in one of the city's poshest neighbourhoods. But its facade is half hidden by an absolutely enormous hedge. It really is of ridiculous proportions. And so the San Francisco Chronicle architecture critic, he wrote about it being, quote, comically off-putting. A columnist from the paper then weighed in and wrote his own story about the hedge. And he added insult to injury by calling her a snob because in the past she's made comments about how San Franciscans don't like to get dressed up. So all this upset about hedge. And then Danielle Steele herself, she sent a 3-page typewritten letter to the newspaper complaining about her treatment over her hedge and noting all the charity work she's done in the city. And she wrote, "Who cares about my hedge? Who else's hedge are they measuring? Have they got nothing better to do?" And now we've gone somewhere even more ridiculous than that. Tom Perkins, who's founder of a famous venture capital firm and actually Danielle Steele's ex-wife, he published a letter in the Wall Street Journal, in fact, saying that a progressive Kristallnacht could be coming to San Francisco, and says the attacks on Danielle Steele and her hedge, who he calls our number one celebrity, are perhaps one sign of this approaching progressive Kristallnacht. So this is all about a hedge, let me remind you.
Well, I pulled up the pictures. It is a mighty bush, as you might say, and it surrounds, it does, it's high. And I see that she says it's because people are nosy. They kind of sit on the hill opposite and kind of look into her interior and try and take photos. But he's getting a little bit carried away, you know, and I'm sure there will be some backlash, you imagine, calling it Kristallnacht, you know, referring to kind of the worst nights for Jews in Europe, comparing that to Daniel Steele's Bush issues, are a bit complicated, aren't they?
Yeah, I mean, the response to that comment has basically been that whenever you start comparing things to the Holocaust, it's a sign that you've gone a little bit off the rails and you need to take a deep breath and step back. So, I mean, the hedge, as you say, is demonstrably huge, and these people who've been making fun of it say that it's fair game. But I agree, you know, comparing it to the Holocaust.
Well, one of the things it may do for her hedge, there's a drought in California.
There is a drought in California. Recently, the governor declared an official drought and is actually the worst that California has seen since records began about a century ago. This January has been completely bone dry. There are forest fire warnings in the state, and even salmon, for example, who depend on rainfall to replenish rivers for their annual migrations, are said to be threatened by extinction. So it really is a terrible environmental situation at the moment.
Well, just dragging out the hedge links, some people who might like to hide behind a hedge at the moment are the people who run Uber, the taxi service. Could you just tell us what's going on there?
It's
all about the hedge.
Well, so Uber and companies like it, these companies that provide these taxi-like services, they carry people around, although they say they're not taxis and don't have licenses. They're already quite controversial because established taxi companies that say, you know, we have to pay tons of fees and pay for licenses, and Uber doesn't have to, and that's unfair. And Uber says that basically the whole taxi system is a relic of the past and that they just are more efficient and should prevail. Now, they would like to hide behind a hedge right now because over the New Year holiday, a young girl was killed in San Francisco by an Uber driver. And the family is now suing Uber, saying that although this driver didn't have a passenger in his back seat, he was still logged into the Uber system and so was potentially distracted by having his smartphone on in the car. And this is going to be a litmus test for Uber and companies like it. They've basically got along so far by saying they are merely a platform. They don't really, they're just a conduit for passengers to hire drivers, and they're not responsible for what the drivers do. But now with this family trying to hold Uber responsible for this tragedy, it seems that Uber maybe can't be quite as laissez-faire about who they hire. They may have to, in fact, become a little bit more like a regular taxi company, which they're trying to, the kind of companies that they're trying to distance themselves from in the first place.
Well, Alistair, thank you very much for coming on the show. And I know you should listen to The Urbanist on Thursday. But Alistair's also done another transport-based report, which is about the shuttle services being used by the likes of Google and Facebook in San Francisco. And he's talking about why they're causing such a kerfuffle. Anyway, that was our perfectly pruned and well-rooted correspondent in San Francisco. That was Alistair G. And that was his top stories from his side of the world. Up next, we'll meet a broadcasting graphic designer who entertains Argentina with his Icon of the Week drawings. Stay tuned for more on this episode of Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Tuck.
The entrepreneur seeks out the seers, the sages and the successes of the business world. Every week, we take you on an hour-long tour to uncover the hidden, extraordinary, curious and inspiring stories you won't hear anywhere else.
It is a beautiful brand that it's all about giving the consumer the best possible product. We didn't buy into a design studio or a commercial entity, we bought into a factory.
We put a shingle on the door, so to speak, which said Brand Strategy Company 25 years ago, and people thought we were just mad parts and really didn't get what we were about.
From the kiosk owners of Cairo to the coffee culture of Tel Aviv, from the beer brewers of Ghana to the piano makers of Greece. Intrigued? Well, tune in to hear how the best entrepreneurial minds tick, not just the ups and downs of the FTSE.
There's a push maybe that people want to have more of their stuff made locally because they know where it's coming from.
You get obsessed about the details And if you're making the same product day in, day out, you build this incredible product that is very difficult to replicate.
So if you have an idea and want to drop that 9-to-5, you've just found your new business Bible. That's The Entrepreneurs, premiering every Wednesday at 1900 hours UK time in association with Pictet.
Each week, Section D takes a thorough look at the design world. From fashion to furniture, from lighting to tasteful living, we'll bring you the most interesting news from design studios across the globe.
Where is society going? What is the furniture that will lead what society will want in terms of furniture functions and forms?
We see that more and more contemporary designers actually do not think about the mass-produced object. That's not what drives them. That's not what they're interested in. That's not what they think they want to contribute to this world.
You can't really create 240 years of a story. What I'm saying is the brand has incredible authenticity and creates integrity.
It's not just making clothes, but shoes and accessories and thinking about the character or the narrative of the collection.
Join me, Tom Morris, on Section D, your one-stop guide to the world of design.
That's Section D, premiering every Tuesday at 1900 hours London time, in association with Lexus.
And welcome back to Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck. Now, you're going to have to focus for the next bit, because this takes some thinking about. Hernán Berdichevsky is one of Argentina's best-known graphic designers, with an international roster of clients from Colombia and Chile to the United States. Perhaps more surprisingly for a visual artist, he's also a radio broadcaster too. It all started back in 2012, when Berdichevsky started drawing images of icons to sum up the news on a weekly show on Metro Radio. But what's the point of designing visuals for the airwaves? Well, Berdichevsky describes them to anyone who tunes in. Now he's also revealing his designs in a new book, Icono de la Semana. We sent Monocle's Ed Stocker to meet him.
Diseñador.
Berdichevsky.
Hernán Berdichevsky. ¿Cómo le va, amigo?
¿Cómo andan?
¿Cómo estás? ¿Bien?
Todo bárbaro. ¿Ustedes?
Muy bien. Perfecto acá. Contanos, Hernán, el icono que armaste.
The idea of the icon of the week, it was to designed to represent the most influential or important news from the world and became an icon and to talk, to explain through the radio.
Okay, so you started talking on a radio show every week, every Friday, about this icon that you designed. But obviously, how is it explaining a drawing, something graphic, on the radio?
Well, the idea is a little bit crazy, but it was good because all the people try to imagine the graphic, and I try to explain, not to describe, to explain the idea through the design. And it's a beautiful way to explain or to introduce to the mass media the graphic idea.
Obviously, this started as your own project, you designing every Friday in your office, and then became a radio show, and then a book published at the end of last year. So how did the book project come about?
When I started to design every Friday the icon of the week, all the people start to comment through the Facebook or whatever, or Twitter, or even an email or telephone, to explain many things about the icon, and all the people are excited to see every Friday these icons. And I start to think to produce a beautiful book with 52 different icons related for the past year, the 2013, to explain how is living in 2013, whatever, in Argentina or in every country, and to remember the news through the graphics and a text who follow the graphic. It was amazing because you saw many, many news that don't you remember in the past year, and wow, is what this year is amazing. The story, for example, for the Pope, for Argentina, is very powerful news. And we start to think to develop a book, and you looking for the resources, and I got it, and I produced a Beautiful, beautiful book.
Okay, so we've got the book here. Can you just choose for me? Let's have a flick through the book and maybe we can talk about the icons that stood out the most to you.
For example, the past year we had several train crash in Buenos Aires, actually, and I designed a beautiful and powerful icon that is a mix between a skull with a train that is so powerful in black background.
Yes, it is. I mean, it's a train carriage, a white train carriage. Looking at it from the front, towards the bottom of the carriage are three circles. You know, it's a very simple drawing, but extremely effective. The two bigger circles are eyes, and I guess the smaller circle is kind of the nose, you know, that forms the skeleton, suggesting death through the railway, as it were. So simple but extremely powerful. So I'm a big fan of that one too. Let's move on to another one, shall we?
Okay, I choose Habemus Papa is with the Pope was elected, is Francis. This was tremendous news. Pope from Argentina is an amazing, amazing. I can't believe it. All the people in Facebook and ask me, you need to design the Pope right now. And I design in half an hour and publish, and is so simple and powerful. This is Pope Francis.
You know, one of the things about living in Argentina is that people say to me, you know, oh, look, we have the footballer Leo Messi, we have the Pope. It's like people kind of look for these icons. So do you think that's true? And did it make your job, I guess, easier?
Yes, for me, the Argentinian is like a producer of icon producers. If you remember Gardel, for example, or Evita, or even Perón, or Maradona, Messi, and the last one, the Pope. I don't know why. For me, it's like...
Don't forget the Queen of Holland.
Oh, the Queen. In the same year, the Queen. For me, it's like natural for us. We produce icon, I don't know how. But for me, it's amazing because it's a factory to design. Every week, we have a different icon from Argentina or even from the world.
And finally, let's just talk a little bit about the future. Have you got any new projects in the pipeline? Tell me a bit about what's coming up next.
We start to think to develop and to create a new museum for the identity of Argentina, Argentine identity, all over in a huge building, the t-shirt of a football team or the mate of a national hero like San Martin, mixed with the most important movies in Argentina or even the music of the tango in the same place. If you came to this museum, you understand how we live and how we think in Argentina. This is the next step for us.
Entiendo. Muy bien, ya pueden entrar al blog de Metro y Medio, que es metroymedio.metro951.com. El icono de la semana, como no podía ser de otra manera, es la pulga. Leo Messi, por cuarto año consecutivo.
Ah, muy bien. That was the graphic designer Hernán Berdichevsky speaking to Monocle's Buenos Aires correspondent Ed Stocker.
If you're after a soundtrack to your working day, look no further than Monocle 24's Globally Minded playlist. We play the very best upbeat music from around the world, around the clock. Whether that's jazz from Japan, pop from Paris, house from Hamburg, or soul from Seoul. It's all picked by our team and presented by our editors. So get lost in music with Monocle 24's playlist right here, day and night, on Monocle 24.
Over the past year, Monocle has sent its correspondents across dozens of countries on a giddying array of planes, trains, and automobiles to gather up the very best in cabins, concourses, suites, and tables. And we've edited these together in a photographic slideshow for you to watch at your leisure.
Japan's southerly island prefecture has everything a tropical paradise should have. White beaches, clear waters, balmy weather, and a slow pace of life. One thing that has been in short supply is high-end hospitality. The Ritz-Carlton has done its bit by opening its luxury Okinawa outpost in the Kiza Country Club.
Monocle's latest travel top 50, now playing in the films menu on monocle.com.
You're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Tuckin. It's currently 18:49 here in London. And this is the point of the show where we have our cultural moment, as it were. And today I'm joined by music journalist Luke Turner, associate editor of The Quietus, an online music magazine covering everything from Egyptian hip-hop to Nordic metal and everything in between. I'm not sure what's in between those two.
Many things.
Many things. A lot of noise, I would imagine. Well, thank you very much for coming to see us, Luke.
Thank you.
We've got three songs that you've chosen, three tracks rather, chosen by you. And we're going to start with, well, let's hear a little bit of the first one and then you can tell us all about it. This is Wild Beasts and the track is called Wanderlust. Now, Luke, they're a band that have been around for a little while, aren't they?
Yeah, I mean, this is their fourth album. I first saw them years ago now when they were a sort of four ribald young men from Kendal with these two vocalists with incredible voices, as you've heard there. And they were primarily a guitar band when they started, but as they've got on, the sound's really smoothed out. This new album, Present Tense, that song's called Wanderlust, that's taken from it. It's very electronic, it's very... very smooth sounding record, and that's probably one of the most upbeat songs. And they're kind of, you know, indie music can be a bit of a limited genre. And
so when you were clicking through the genre, they'd be under indie rock, would they?
Or? I suppose they were once. Counted out. I don't know what they are now. I mean, they said, I've got a quote, I spoke to them.
They're not Egyptian hip hop.
No, definitely not. There is a band called Egyptian hip hop who aren't at all Egyptian hip hop, sadly. And I interviewed them recently, and they sort of insisted that this record was very electronic and smooth and sounded like various things from the 80s and 90s. They had no compulsion whatsoever to make adult pop. That's what they said. But it is kind of an adult pop record. It's interesting that they've kind of come around that route from indie to making something that's a bit more subtle,
I think. Now, for our global listeners, we should explain that Kendal is known for one other thing, mint cake.
Mint cake, yes.
Yeah. It's a kind of very sweet, sweet sugary thing. And it's in the Lake District, right up in the north of England. Just tell me, when you see these bands, you know, obviously talented, obviously, you know, people have stuck together for years doing it, they haven't quite hit the big time. How do they survive? Are they surviving on gigging, on writing for other people? How does a band like that keep going for, you know, they've been going since, you know, 2002, apparently.
Yeah, I mean, most people will probably have heard Wild Beasts without realising it from an HSB advert. There was a tiny bit of their music used in a very widely screened commercial a few years ago. That would have kept them going. And Wild Beasts are a very hard-working band. I mean, they tour constantly, and they've had the longest time off touring before this record, writing this one. But they're kind of in the grindstone of it, really, which you have to do now as an artist, whether you're a band or a solo person. There's no lolling around, no let up in the kind of work required, really.
There's no lolling here either, actually. And now we're going to move on. Next is East India Youth. And let's hear a sample of their track. This is Dripping Down. Our engineer was saying, leave it a second. I think because he was worried, I thought they were going to be a very miserable bunch of... But they cheered up there. They started slow, but they did cheer up. Now tell me, you've had a bit of a professional collision with these
people. We have, full disclosure. Well, it's only one person, a young man called William Doyle, who records as East India Youth. We well, the quietest was involved with him because he approached my colleague John Doran at a gig and gave him a CD and said, "Well, you're from the quietest. Will you listen to my album?" And John did, and he loved it, and I loved it. And we'd always thought about putting out a record, but we don't want to put out anything rubbish or something that people would expect. And we felt there was a real sort of strange pop thing, a bit of a melancholy pop, but we like melancholy pop in what he did. So we released an EP last year that went down very well. And now that song's taken from his album, Total Strife Forever, which came out a few weeks ago, not on anything to do with the quietest, completely new label. And it's gone down a storm. Like, he's had full page features in The Sun, and Brian Eno's a fan. You know, it's kind of a...
So he gave him a leg up, and then he scarpered.
Yeah, give him a leg up, and they're over the wall, over the barbed wire and off.
But Aisha, you reference The Sun there. Is that important still these days, getting the backing of the tabloids and the main newspapers as well? Do they help a band?
I think, I mean, it's been interesting sort of seeing what's happened with the East Indie Youth thing. I've sort of heard that it's sold quite a lot of records, really, and... in the few weeks it's been out, and apparently a lot of them were on, maybe this is confidential information, who cares, a lot of them were on CD, and I think that's your Sun reader, or the Sunday Times did a big review of this album and said it was the first masterpiece of 2014, which is going to be worth a few sales. So I think that stuff really does count still.
Now we've got one to quickly fit in before we have to say goodbye, and this is a surprise. This is the Charlotte Church of all people, and this is Death and Mathematics. For our global audience, who was child star, kind of like choral, saintly, good girl gone bad, you know, she was tabloid fodder, not kind of taken very seriously by lots of people, but suddenly lots of people are saying Charlotte Church.
Yeah, I mean, I mean, she got treated appallingly by the tabloids. If you need an example of how repellent the press are in this country, I think Charlotte Church's treatment at their hands is a very good example. Yeah, you know, she was, you know, she grew up in the public eye, then went and sort of tried to go away from choral stuff to do pop things that didn't quite work. I first interviewed her years ago, and I just really liked how intelligent she was, how she, when you play music to her, we got her to review some stuff, and she can take it apart in a way that nobody else can, because she really knows
and
what she's on
and
about.
And this latest recording is great?
Yeah, I mean, this is a new EP. She's done four EPs recently. This is EP 4, and this is the best one. There's just so many different influences. She writes brilliant pop songs. She's dead smart. Quietest really loves her. People are very surprised. I think we're being ironic or something. It's like, no, we think she's fantastic. Big Charlotte Church fans.
Brilliant, Luke. Well, she's going to actually be popping into Monocle, so we'll hear on Monocle 24 as well. But that's all we have time for on today's Midori House. My thanks in particular to our special guests earlier, James Boyes and Shashank Yoshi, and of course, Luke Turner too. Today's show was produced by Daphne Denis, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and also Anade Situma. And our studio manager was Alex Funnell. Sorry about that. Up next is Section D with Tom Morris, where we'll be at Maison et Objets in Paris, and we'll also be at the Interior Design Show and Design Offsite at Toronto Design Week.
What we tried to do is create a room that took the viewer completely out of the Gladstone Hotel and put them into a completely different realm or a different environment. What we tried to do is take one individual's private experience and put that on public display.
Then at 2200 hours, it's the Monocle Daily with Andrew Muller and Chloe Potter. This show will be back at the same time tomorrow, at 1800 hours London time. But for this edition of Midori House, it's goodbye from me, Andrew Tuck, and thank you for listening.
Tells the story of a passion for motor racing. A legend forged over time by the pioneers of speed and great drivers. The Daytona Cosmograph. The watch made to break barriers. The watch dedicated to endurance. The watch that was born to race. Rolex.